Writing is easy. All you do is sit down at a typewriter and open a vein. Red Smith. We are scribblers, people possessed with an odd need to bleed. Inspired shaman, barometers of the irregular impulse, petri dishes for inspiration. We are writers, and most of us feel that if we had to be left on a desert island with any group of people, we'd probably choose each other. Today's Mind's Eye writers are not marooned. In fact, we gladly join together to let you in on what makes us engage in this strange and annoying art in Dwelling in Possibility or The Writing Life. Gaither Voldsen discovers that asking the right questions, even if unanswerable, goes a long way towards creation.
Since being given this topic on The Writing Life, I've been stumped as to where to go with it. To say something that hasn't already been said about the trials and traumas, the glories and grandiosity of The Writing Life, what of importance would I have to add? So I finally had to sit down and write. The wonderful part about deadlines. And as usual with any writing project, after writing two or three pages, I floundered my way to an idea, or at least a question that needs answering. Which is exactly what I've been after when I write, answering questions. The fact is, the longer I write, the more I feel that each writing project is like a Zen koan, those essentially unanswerable questions usually given by Zen masters to their students to grapple with. But with writing, instead of a master presenting me with a question, I give them to myself. And once I've got a suitable question, my job is to stumble around with this dilemma in mind, and hopefully, in a sweep of suddenly flowing syllables and narrative traction, have the question go poof and turn into a lovely revelatory poem or story with a surprise twist, or at least a white rabbit. Answer an unanswerable question by using this mountain of words and sentence possibilities. There, that's it, my writing life. I have found that, as with the Zen koans that the Buddhists employ to sharpen their mind, deepen their understanding of the cosmos, it's the journey through the question is mostly why I write, not the result at the end. Like a couple of days ago, that moment when I was not writing, but shoveling snow in a blizzard, and out of the woven white of horizontal snow emerges a brown Indian man in a polar bear white, full-length wool coat. He floats up to me and asks me, in a thick Indian accent, "Excuse me, please, but this is my first time in snow, and might I borrow a shovel?" When he pulled his hands out of his pocket, I expected mangoes or bright orange nasturtiums. It was a groovy, surreal moment, but I don't leave it at that. Instead, I turn it into a koan. Why or how or did the Indian man appear in the snowstorm? Of course, though, I'm no Zen master yet, so the motivation for engaging in these questions, or even the integrity of the questions themselves, varies. For example, when I deign to share my completed answers with others, especially if it pleases or moves them, I feel helpful, that I've brought something good into the world, entertained someone, taken their mind off the mundane. This motivation to write makes me feel somewhat infantile, like a child bringing home a bouquet of dandelions to my mother. Other times my motivation is egotistical, and I imagine this particular small question I posed has potential for a great poem, and finally, I will get rewarded and praised for my keen insight and stellar command of the language. "His deft strokes gives life to the ordinary," the reviews would read. And of course, along with the deft strokes comes fame and women and a cozy writer's life. More childish desires. Other times I force a problematic question upon myself to write my way out of, because my writing group meets in an hour, and I'd promised I'd have something written by then. Other times my quest is oh so romantic, to express in metaphorical terms a surge of love for my girlfriend or parents, or an oh-so-dire surge of despair to express the depth of my losses. These require no questions. Most times, though, it's just being curious, loving the challenge of the mysterious conundrum, attempting to metamorphize the unspoken, turn the undescribed into the described, pull daisies through the cracks of the sidewalk. But regardless of the motivation, once I begin the process of feeling my way out of the question box, the koan, my what the Buddhists would call earthbound motivations take a back seat, during which time my dinner burns and my daughter shouts at me to no avail. It's not necessarily a calm place. In fact, it's often a raging fire of doubt and passion and upset as I try to figure out what lies in the eight-sided rubric cube. How I tell this story I'm trying to tell. And then, at some point, a first draft arrives. I hold my answer to my cone, my story, up to the light. I read it to my writer's group, revise a few more times, and I am done, often never to return to that piece again. Which is how I remember feeling when I was a full-time carpenter. Once a job was done, I had little interest in revisiting the job. And it wasn't that I wasn't fully engaged in every detail I touched. But when it's done, it's done. A house is a house. A story is a story. A rose is a rose. A question is a question. Best of all are the moments when I feel I have been found by my question, by my words, that the simple act of writing marks on a paper in search of answering life's koans has had its own humorous or profoundly ironic way with me, fooling me for weeks on end into thinking I'm about to catch, there in the dark pool of pond, something new and wonderful and grand on the end of my fishing line. When in fact, I am standing there all along with this creel full of rainbow trout and the brilliant warm sun caressing my back. This I love. I'll end with a poem by another answerer of questions, Juan Ramon Jimenez, that I think captures a bit of the mystery I'm attempting to unravel. The poem is called Oceans. I have a feeling that my boat has struck down there in the depths against a great thing, and nothing happens. Nothing. Silence. Waves. Nothing happens? Or has everything happened, and are we standing now, quietly, in the new life? This is Guy Thorvaldsen for Mind's Eye Radio.
Paul Thompson found out early in his writer's life what at least one editor was not seeking. Books channeled by aliens, demons, dead relatives, dead celebrities. Books that you personally guarantee will be bestsellers because some living, dead, or supernatural third party or tarot deck said it would.
I finished writing a novel last fall, tentatively entitled Always Nancy, about a woman involved in the rise of the credit union movement. I intended to publish the novel myself. Writer friends who looked at the script, however, suggested that I try to find a commercial publisher. One major challenge is that the publishing business has consolidated and is dominated by a few giant publishing houses. Meanwhile, they've been cutting back on editorial staff and increasingly relying on agents to bring them material. Most agents are former employees of publishing firms who either departed in search of greener pastures or were involuntarily retired. So rather than submitting my novel to publishers themselves, a long, drawn-out process that can take years, I'm looking for an agent. Which is not so easy either. You can find agents listed in books like the Writer's Digest and on the web. The usual procedure is to submit a one-page letter of inquiry describing your novel, and for some agents, the first chapter or so of your manuscript. The agent can take up to several months to respond, however, so if you do it sequentially, this can also take years. Fortunately, there are agents who accept simultaneous submissions, and even more fortunately, some of these accept email queries. So I've been able to speed up my search by sending email queries to some 30 agents over the past few weeks. Of course, these agents, like the publishing houses themselves, are looking for the most potentially profitable writers, and they often receive hundreds of queries each week. Yes, there are thousands of would-be novelists out there. So the typical agent is quite picky, understandably so. Agents are not interested in shepherding a beginning writer toward publication. They seek a quick payoff. Their websites are quite honest about the difficulties of catching their interest. Many are willing only to work with established authors, or authors referred to them, or ones they have personally met at writers' conferences. Or they say that their client list is full and they are no longer accepting new submissions. One agent accepts only submissions from authors whose initials match two letters she places on her website and which she changes monthly. Some of the agents sound grumpy, as if they're overwhelmed by all the bad writing in the world. Keller Media in California, headed by Wendy Keller, notes that it doesn't want, among other things, as she puts it, books channeled by aliens, demons, dead relatives, dead celebrities, books your mother, grandmother, best friend told you really should get written, stories relayed by animals that you typed up on their behalf, or books that you personally guarantee will be bestsellers because some living, dead, or supernatural third party or tarot deck said it would. This means the query letter has to be as inviting as possible, like baiting a fishing hook. And you have to be as tough as a fisherman sitting in the rain being eaten up by mosquitoes as you receive rejection after rejection. These rejections, of course, are form responses. Some are politely brief. Thank you for the query, although I do not think that I would be the right agent for this particular novel. Sincerely, Diana Finch. Others are more extensive and sympathetic, but are still rejections. Dear Mr. Thompson, thanks so much for sending your query and for offering me the chance to consider your material. Unfortunately, your project does not seem right for me. Since it's crucial that you find an agent who will represent you to the best of his or her ability, I'm going to have to step aside from asking to represent your manuscript. You should know that my decision reflects my present workload and the type and amount of material which I'm presently representing. It does not reflect on your material, and I certainly encourage you to continue to seek representation, especially since this is such a subjective business. What works for one agent or publisher may not work as well for another. I'm afraid, though, that I can't recommend someone else for it. Best of luck, Jeff Kleinman. I love that phrase. I'm going to have to step aside from asking to represent your manuscript. As if Jeff was regretfully declining an invitation to a really good party. To change my fishing metaphor, I feel a little bit like a salmon fighting its way upriver past waterfalls, dams, and other obstacles, while exhausted or dead bodies of other salmon drift past me back toward the ocean of anonymity. I won't take this metaphor too far, however. Even salmon who make it often end up eaten by bears. I can always join those thousands of hopeful writers who self-publish. I think my Aunt Dorothy, at least, would buy a copy. For Mind's Eye Radio, this is Paul Thompson.
Like many writers, Louise Mancuso, once she realized that writing might not be the superhighway to wealth and popularity, began to culture younger writers.
Ah, yes, a writer's life. Bestsellers, parties where we talk with other writers about books and ideas, first-class seating on a jet to wherever we want to go. For a tennis buff, it would be England and Wimbledon, New York for the U.S. Open, Melbourne, my favorite, for the Australian. A house in the mountains and one by the sea. Anything is open to you. Money is no object. People stand in line to see you and hear you, hang on your every word. Maybe you have the answer for them, how it is they should live to get the most out of life, not be afraid, stay young and thin and full of energy to the end of their days. How sublime if our words help. But for this writer, there aren't that many people who have heard or read me. I'll most likely never have that bestseller to reach millions, but I do have some lighthearted articles out there, and a few short stories and even poems. I've also been carrying around a couple of book manuscripts for a good number of years that may yet get to see the light of day while I am still here. Or maybe not till after. It doesn't really matter. What I've learned is this. There is no one way to live a life. No one way to paint or sculpt or dance or sing or write. There is your way that is given to you, that you must seek and find and embrace, not only for your sake, but for those for whom your work will have meaning. And you never know who that is or when it will be. That's why good works should never be unavailable. They need to be there for that person some years down the line who is sick at heart or lonely or at their wit's end, who will duck into a bookstore or second-hand shop or flea market, whose eyes will be drawn to the title on the cover of the book you once had published or photocopied or hand-printed. The tiny zine you put together in your teens or 20s, someone will see that and take hold of it and smile or laugh, and even more importantly, take comfort from it. Isn't that what most of us hope for in our writing, even more than just getting the words down? And speaking of zines, there is a college student I met at the Zine Fest held in Madison a couple of years ago whose name is Sam. He puts out a publication called The Puny Whipster, which he sells for a dollar or donation or gives away for free. He loves to play with words, is in love with life and the world. He is just starting out. I am near to my end time. Because of his young years, Sam might come off to some as being cocky and full of himself, but I know there will be times when he and others who are just starting out to follow their dream may feel dejected and unsure of themselves. It may be then that this thought-provoking tongue-in-cheek piece that appeared in a recent issue of the Rambler magazine may prove to be of some help. It's called After My Most Recent Rejection, number 135, and was written by Tom Holmes. I'm going to go cry now and slit the wrist of my pencil till all the lead slides out. I'll do it over a piece of paper, see if I can catch the pencil's last words, see if the pencil writes something in its dying desperation. Maybe its last words will be emotionally charged. Maybe its last words will be the words I have been waiting for. Maybe the pencil finally learned how to write and speak, and it just needed a deep emotional conflict, needed to feel pain before it could tell the truths of its leaden heart. Maybe I just can't read pencil. Maybe I should use a pen with smooth-flowing blue blood, or maybe a pen with black blood. Yes, black blood obviously means the pen has suffered, has had experiences, and would know how to write better than a lightweight pencil cut out of a tree. Maybe I should go find the tree, look at its scar. That way I could know the pencil, know its whole history. I could see its birth, feel its life, and watch it die. Maybe I should find a passion-filled, red-blooded pen. But I know that passion would just turn to rejection. My first-grade teacher did that to me with her red-blooded check marks. I think I need to know my pencil better. Maybe I should just turn the pencil upside down and unwrite everything. Go back to the beginning. Go back and draw on the base of living room walls. Sam, and others just starting out, have a long way to go to collect 135 rejection slips. But I have already picked up choice bits from Sam's humble zine, especially where, in the latest issue, he quotes a respected author who wrote, "Nothing great was ever achieved without enthusiasm. For what is enthusiasm but the oblivion and swallowing up of self in an object dearer than self?" I have been finding it difficult for a number of years now to rekindle the fires of enthusiasm I felt in my earlier years of writing when I completed the two novels I'd been carrying around while working as a babysitter and companion aide. I garnered many rejection slips, but I also had my work read and critiqued by a New York agent and author Mae Sarton, and got to take classes from the likes of Rita Mae Brown, Maxine Kumin, Rhoda Lerman, and here in Wisconsin, Abby Frucht, Ellen Court, and Allison Townsend. I read my work in front of open mic audiences at the once-heralded Writer's Place here in Madison that hosted its share of well-known and respected writers from all over the country. So I guess I've had a very small taste of what it's like to be a writer, and as such, it may have to do me for the rest of my life. But that's okay. I wouldn't know what to do with a big house anyway. This is Louise Mancuso for Mind's Eye Radio.
Evelyn Thompson started her writing life on the practical side as a journalist, of which she says, "That was the beginning of my understanding that if I wanted to report honestly what I saw, I would not have many friends, and that that is the downside of reporting."
The first time I got paid for writing was as a part-time reporter for a couple of weekly newspapers. I was 39 and had no training, but I had been writing reviews of art shows for a cooperative gallery where I showed my artwork. And when I saw the ad for the job, I took three of my pieces that had been published in our respected daily paper and applied. They turned me down, but I suggested that if they ever needed anyone to fill in, I would be happy to have the work. They did need me, and shortly I was writing for them a couple times a week, mostly covering village and town board meetings. The ace up my sleeve was that I was married to a professional writer, who was also a former reporter, and he was willing to take what I'd written and critique it, sometimes suggesting specific ways to improve the pieces. I was paid $10 to $15 per piece, which worked out to about 75 cents an hour. If the deadline was the next morning after the meeting, I would come home at 10 or 11 at night, write the piece, get my husband out of bed so he could critique it, rewrite it, get a couple of hours sleep, and then deliver it to the newspaper office. Our younger child was 5 and going to kindergarten, and I had a very maternal look about me. I was definitely not the young, up-and-coming journalist. At first, this worked to my advantage in a strange way. The members of the boards didn't expect me to understand what they were talking about. One night after a meeting, one unsuspecting board member took me aside to complain extensively about the town's relationship with their engineers. I pretty much got it all down in my notes and reported it. At the next meeting of the board, an engineering firm representative spoke up to complain that his firm had been mortified to read of these difficulties in the papers before they had even been informed there was a problem. After that, my cover was blown. I began the long period of board members trying to keep me from understanding what was going on. On one occasion, for example, they tried to conceal which plat of land they were talking about for development. And then, in response to my persistence, one of them, realizing they were violating the open meeting law, told me where the property was located. In the other small town I covered, a board member gave me the wrong time for a meeting. The meeting was to review and discuss a conflict over a drainage problem involving a couple of residents' properties. Obviously, it was more tactful to do that quietly, out of the public eye. Another time I sat with an environmental group on a circle of folding chairs. They were about to discuss how to get land condemned for a conservation area. Earlier, I had written an article reporting in some detail how a retired couple at a hearing said they didn't want their land condemned because it represented their life savings, and they needed to sell it in the open market in order to get a decent sum that would cover their needs. Most of the environmentalists in the circle wanted me thrown out. I understood their anger. I just sat there with them, glowering at me for what seemed like a very long time. Because of the circle seating, I felt very exposed, with nothing, not even a chair, between us. Then one of their leaders spoke up and said that they couldn't throw me out because it was a public meeting. And did they want to cancel the meeting? They went ahead and met, and afterwards he talked to me for a while, hoping, I think, to influence the story I would write. I'd been an environmentalist my whole life and was basically in sympathy with their goals, but I wrote the story straight just as I'd seen it. There was a phone call the next day from one of their leaders, a woman I knew and liked, but I still didn't feel I could shape the stories to fit their needs. That was the beginning of my understanding that if I wanted to report honestly what I saw, I would not have many friends, and that that is the downside of reporting. The upside was that I had a front row seat at this wonderful political theater. I was surprised to learn that so much of what went into running a city or town fascinated me. Things like jamming a Christmas tree down deep inside a municipal well to keep it open when there were no other alternatives. I loved it all, and even the negative responses from people were entertaining when looked at over the long haul. I was sorry to leave that job after a year, but my family needed me to bring in some support money, and 75 cents an hour just wasn't going to cut it. This is Evie Thompson from Mind's Eye Radio.
Where do poets get their inspirations? Sometimes, sadly, the news of the day haunts the nights of the writer, as Judith Zuckerman well understands.
Haunted by the front pages of the New York Times but a few Sundays ago, I couldn't sleep until I filled the blank page. Happy birthday. He helped blow out the candle on his son's birthday cake, only to return to Iraq. But his whole unit had been ambushed during his two-week family leave. When his third tour ended, he felt his wife's unspoken words, "You are not the man I married. I want a divorce." He killed her. His son is an orphan. Who changed this soldier who spent his 26th birthday in a jail cell? In court, they declared, he'll pay for his crime. Whose crime? This is Judith Zuckerman from Mind's Eye Radio.
Lynn Patrick Smith nurses no delusions about the gentle nature of poets.
The poet. I always thought he wrote his poems backward, then read them forward, and the lines he didn't like were neatly guillotined. He was so recklessly precise. At dawn, the lines that had escaped the guillotine were marched out single file with matching blindfolds, never making it through their final cigarette. This is Lynn Patrick Smith for Mind's Eye Radio.
Every occupation has its tools, and writing seems minimalist in this regard, but not if you're Norma Gay Pruitt, who practically makes a fetish of the things of the trade.
Now that I look more like Norma Desmond than Norma Jean, as the shadows of my nose begin to overtake the moguls of my chins, I muse about what brought me here, to this edge of the couch, with a laptop propped on edge of ottoman, poking these flipping signals into a box that glows and flickers like a modern campfire, and, like the campfire, causes my eyelids to twitch if I stare at it too long. I started scribbling like a mouse starts nibbling, from instinct, I think, when I was a skinny 9. I wrote with pen. I've always hated pencils for writing. They are so stingy, though I love a Boston Blackie for drawing. In my family, both paper and writing utensils were scarce and therefore prized. I probably wrote on the big chief tablet that my mother kept around for writing letters. In my childhood home, if you wanted a writing utensil for something utilitarian and clearly in the interests of the world, like homework, you could borrow Daddy's ballpoint pen. But you had to sit at the table beside him and never leave the room with it. And this was no fancy Crossman pen. Dad's was probably a cheap plastic freebie from the grain elevator. But he was a man who constantly did figures for his work, and besides, the pen was his, and there may have been something Freudian there, since he had anywhere from 1 to 7 kids during his long tenure as king, each one constantly trying to make off with his pen. Anyhow, I crouched at the kitchen table and painfully bled poetry of the falling on the thorns of life variety. And when I turned the first one in, which began, "The last rose of summer, so sad and forlorn, twas, yes, twas, the last rose that blah, 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 born," my teacher promptly and publicly pronounced it plagiarism. I cried and summoned the nerve to insist that she call my big sister, a school star, down from the 8th grade to attest to its originality. She did. I was vindicated, but I never got an apology. But she's dead, and I'm still alive. Perhaps, if it's true that living well is the best revenge, I guess just outliving is some solace. It turns out that I was not the first writer in my family. The same sister that defended me was a crackerjack journalist. She won awards, protected, and pushed me toward what I naturally gravitated toward anyhow, and then set me spinning like a top toward the precipice of trying to make a living as a writer. After I graduated from high school, I wanted nothing more than to be a famous landscape painter. Then, when I graduated with a B.A. in English, I tried my lance at freelancery for a year. I took to heart Samuel Johnson's edict, "Nobody but a blockhead ever wrote except for money." When I received my first tiny check, but big to me, for $100, it was for a story way out of my experience about collecting art for investment that I somehow slid over the transom to some editor friend of my sister's. I promptly trotted to the bank and announced I wanted to open an account for all my writing proceeds under my nom de plume of Gay Smith Sublette, the hyphenated maiden names of my mother and her mother. This was a bank in a small town named something like Farmers and Plumbers Bank, so the banker eyed me warily as one regards an exotic kitchen tool, like a flan flamer or something, and asked me to spell it out letter by letter as he edged over to his supervisor's desk to get approval for this very out-of-the-way request. Meanwhile, I perched on the edge of his desk, smoking a Galois and adjusting my beret. I think that account still held the sum of $100 when I closed it out to pay the phone bill or something a year or so later, and these were not phone calls to Harper's and the Paris Review. Poverty knocked some sense into my beret, and I earned 2 more degrees while still pecking out the occasional poem. Most of my scribbling during my grad school career dwarfed my creative stuff under mounds of pretentious academic writing. It was mainly accomplished late at night or early in the morning the day it was due at a royal portable with jeweled escapement that I had scored in some second-hand store. It had a hard shell case that it locked into, but the cover was never closed on it for 4 years. Annoying as hell, but the latest in writerly technology, it jumped and halted and typed over itself. I burned through ribbons, nasty tarry fabric things that blackened the fingers, then naturally, the paper. I never learned to use the tabs or the margin warning thing, so was constantly spilling my treatises on Milton over onto the black cylinder before I saw through bleeding eyes that my paper had vanished, black onto black, into the jeweled escapement. Because professors then were like professors now and insisted on being able to actually decipher the words on the page, I soon learned that the handy product whiteout only produced a sort of hieroglyphic, words on stone, flaky document. I remember even trying the Hail Mary pass of tardiness, trying to paste a clean piece of that slippery-ass paper they used to call onion skin over the offensive mess and typing on that. But I can't recall this method ever succeeding with any professor. To earn my college tuition, I held a job as secretary typist all the way through college, but the irony is that I never liked typing, and only now, years later, can sort of type without looking. Yes, I learned touch typing, but never very well, for the sole and simple reason that I never wanted to be anybody's Girl Friday. Not that I ever dreamed of being boss or anything. I just wanted a job writing heartfelt poems. So when the IBM Selectric typewriter bludgeoned its way onto the office scene, most secretaries worshipped it. I despised it. As Gertrude Stein said of Oakland, California, there was no there there. It seemed insubstantial and required no effort, which made me feel disconnected and would set down a stripe of the same letter if one paused a split second too long on the keys. It scared me, though I kind of liked the blue case and still have one sitting in my attic. The Selectric soon transplanted the portable, though, which gave way to the K-Pro, my first computer, then to the large-bodied desktops of the 90s, and finally, most recently, to the tiny laptops, which really are quite wonderful, though awfully flat. I still pound on it as if I were carving words into stone, and my husband still laughs at me. Ironically, the keyboard still jumps once in a while, just as my old Royal used to, and I can still type ridiculous strings of gibberish with my elbow just by glancing away for a second. Y-Y-Y-Y-Y-L-L-L-K-K-K-B-K-N-O-P-O. You get the idea. But all in all, the writer's life is an easier one these days, though even the best of technology doesn't improve the content of a poem. It just makes it look more impressive when you set it up in Cambria bold. Here you need to imagine that big black typeface. And maybe adding a few emoticons just to send the message home. Edna St. Vincent Millay didn't need the help, but some of us second-rate, ink-stained wretches do. This is Norma Gay Pruitt, making air quotes for Mind's Eye Radio.
Dr. Stringlove, a.k.a. Lewis Rawl, reminds us that folks who work in professions other than the obviously writer-related ones can also benefit from learning to express themselves, though he, not being a blockhead, also writes for money.
Hello, Dr. Stringlove here. Things are quiet around the lab this morning. My assistants are at the observatory for a week to use our precious telescope time. I'm spending the day writing, I'll tell you what, later on. Even though I'm officially a scientist, writing is a big part of my life. This makes me think of advice I would give a bright young person contemplating a career in science or engineering. Learn to write clearly and effectively. The usual prescription is to learn basic science and mathematics well. This is true, of course, but usually the role of writing in advancing and maintaining a career in science, especially in academia, is ignored or underestimated. How do you learn to write? It's hard to say. Some people seem to acquire the knack by osmosis. Reading certainly helps. Doing your own writing with critical feedback is essential. Take courses which require you to write up observations and experiments, solutions to problems, proofs of mathematical theorems, and so on. You don't learn to write by filling in blanks in worksheets or, even worse, using a number 2 pencil to darken circles, ovals, or squares on machine-gradable forms. These make it easy to grade your work and meet the demand to give more and more tests, but learning suffers. It is, in a way, unfortunate that the classic works of Aristotle and Plato have vanished from the curriculum, but there isn't time for everything. The writings of Galileo are considered to meet the highest standard of 16th century Italian literature, and are featured in classes on this arcane subject. Without access to these influences, a simple approach is to ask your teachers which books or papers influenced them. Textbooks are generally devoid of style. Read Scientific American. Its standards are extremely high. Unfortunately, many do not learn how to write until graduate school. At this stage, it is a painful diversion from what one should be spending time learning. However, it is the last chance that many have, better late than never. The main thing is to have something to write about. If you don't have any ideas, it doesn't matter how well you write. Writing is particularly important to academic scientists at the top universities, such as here at UU. This is usually expressed in the disjunction, publish or perish. Personally, I prefer the conjunction, publish and flourish. This pressure to publish developed mostly in the previous century, at least so we think. Books were written starting long ago to summarize current knowledge, but what about new results? In antiquity, scientists would take the time to express their findings in the form of a poem, since poetry was the gold standard of literature at the time. There was even use of puzzles and anagrams. Later, letters were standard, sometimes leading to heated exchanges. As the use of mail became more common, there were people to whom you could write who would copy and distribute your letters to interested persons. It was a short step from this to the first scientific journals about 200 years ago. Now you send your paper to an editor who has knowledgeable people referee it, followed by publication, if acceptable, perhaps after some revision. This system works well, but there is a challenge if one has a completely new idea or one outside the mainstream of the subject. Even if published, such work is usually ignored, at least for a long time. The next step in the importance of publication began 100 years or so ago with the concept of tenure for university professors, essentially lifetime jobs. In some countries, university faculties are staffed with the relatives of those in power. Major universities in the United States decided that the influence of politicians or wealthy donors was pernicious, hence tenure, but for whom? The imperfect system hit upon was to give candidates a limited amount of time to produce an acceptable publication record, hence the disjunction, publish or perish. With success, continued publication was expected, as well as production of students who would achieve distinction, along with appropriate public service. Some see a conflict between research and teaching, but my best professors had good publication records. After all, the investigation, organization, and presentation of material which makes a good scientific paper also makes a good lecture. While there may have been a golden age of academic life, things have changed, at least since World War II. After the war, government and industrial funds became so available that universities were able to expand their research facilities beyond all expectations. This has led, unfortunately, to the present situation, in which your standing at a university is based more on how much money you can bring in instead of pure academic excellence. So, what am I writing? Our latest discoveries? No, I am writing a proposal for funds to keep the lab running for another 2 or 3 years, a document with no scientific or literary merit. In addition to my own selfish interests, I have an obligation to my graduate students to see them through their degrees, and to my postdocs to send them on to good jobs. Unfortunately, science can have writer's block, too. I finished the part on projected work, the supporting ideas and publications, our biographies, and the budget. What I can't think of is a simple characterization of our somewhat offbeat field of study. Wait, I've got it. I'll call it Quantum Universal Astronomical Physics. This has a neat acronym, QUAP, or QUAP for short. I have a good crew, and surely our funding agency will be proud to announce that they support QUAP. This is Dr. Stringlove, still trying to budget more time for Mind's Eye Radio.
Madison writer Josephine Zell.
It is a mark of distinction in the writing life to be named Poet Laureate of the United States. I have been in the presence of one Poet Laureate, have enjoyed a reading on tape of a second, and have found new depth of interest in the reading of classical epic translated by a third. We use the term Poet Laureate of these three writers, William Stafford, Robert Fitzgerald, and Rita Dove, although until the year 1986 the actual title was Consultant in Poetry to the Library of Congress. There was a capacity audience at the former St. Benedict's Center, Middleton, Wisconsin, for the visit of William Stafford in the 1970s. We were captivated by his humility and the sense he gave us that in being present that evening, we were participating in the writing life. He read the title poem of his first major collection, Traveling Through the Dark, in which he comes upon a deer dead at the side of the road above a sheer drop, her fawn still warm inside her, and must decide what to do. High school students, reading that poem, responded to Stafford's humanity, his respect for life, and his fidelity to the moral choice as he saw it. There are few obscure lines in Stafford's poems, but there are challenging lines in abundance. In the following decade, from 1984 to 85, the same title was held by the poet and translator Robert Fitzgerald. He was aged 74 and had published his verse translation of Virgil's Latin epic, The Aeneid, in 1981, a magnificent work, colorful, dramatic, and immensely moving in its tragic scenes, notably the suicide of Dido, the Carthaginian queen. This is a translation that illuminates the original text, holding the interest of juniors and seniors reading the epic in Latin. I have included Fitzgerald in this account of my own writing life because without reading his work I probably would never have written my own poem on Virgil's theme of the triumph of destiny over human love. Though a tenuous connection indeed, I owe my inspiration first to Virgil, the greatest of Roman poets, and secondly to this translator and poet. I feel that I first saw Rita Dove, poet laureate from 1993 to 95, when my students and I discovered her tape recording of her narrative poem sequence, Thomas and Beulah. Two young men set out on a riverboat toward Akron, Ohio, going downriver with a mandolin and a lust for adventure. But the mandolin slips into the water, and when Thomas's buddy dives over the side, both mandolin and man are crushed by the water wheel. With this realism, Rita Dove shocks the reader, only the beginning of many twists and turns, as Thomas courts a young woman, the Beulah of the saga. Dove's method is to have each speak through alternating poems, an intriguing and successful device. In her selected poems, there is also a haunting two-part poem entitled Parsley. It exhibits the force of the speaking word itself in the context of the exercise of terrifying force by the dictator of the Dominican Republic, Rafael Trujillo, on October 2, 1937. He ordered 20,000 Haitian blacks killed because they could not pronounce correctly the rolled letter R in perejil, the Spanish word for parsley. The Haitians spoke French Creole, in which, unlike Spanish, the letter R is not rolled. Haitian blacks worked side by side with Dominicans in the sugarcane fields, so those who could not pronounce it correctly were Haitians. They were forced to lie down in the fields and were shot. What Rita Dove chose to do is to write a plausible account of Trujillo's motive for this genocide. It is based partly on his fierce love for his dead mother, who was a Spanish speaker, and his obsession with correct Spanish pronunciation. In an interview in 1985, the underside of the story, A Conversation with Rita Dove, she said, "It was important to me to try to understand that arbitrary quality of his cruelty, and I'm not afraid of making him too human. Making us get into his head may shock us all into seeing what the human being is capable of, and what, in fact, we're capable of." Rita Dove is the youngest poet laureate and the first African-American to be appointed to the position. And what may not be very well known is that when Dove was invited to the White House, she wanted to talk about the uses to which power had been put. She also wanted to talk about how important it is in all avenues of life to be able to imagine the other person. She wanted to show what evil can do. Having been invited to the White House, she said, she felt she should really show what poetry could do, and that in fact it covers many different aspects of human joy and triumph and tragedy. so she read Parsley, Part 1, to the after-dinner audience. Here is the poem, Parsley. A villanelle, written in the voices of those Haitian workers. The cane fields. There is a parrot imitating spring in the palace, its feathers parsley green. Out of the swamp the cane appears to haunt us, and we cut it down. El General searches for a word. He is all the world there is. Like a parrot imitating spring, we lie down screaming as rain punches through, and we come up green. We cannot speak an R. Out of the swamp the cane appears. And then the mountain we call in whispers Catalina. The children gnaw their teeth to arrowheads. There is a parrot imitating spring. El General has found his word, Perihil. Who says it lives. He laughs, teeth shining out of the swamp. The cane appears in our dreams, lashed by wind and streaming. And we lie down. For every drop of blood, there is a parrot imitating spring. Out of the swamp, the cane appears. That was part one of the poem Parsley by Rita Dove. These three poets, William Stafford, Robert Fitzgerald, and Rita Dove, have all reached the stature of poets laureate. I've used them to teach poetry as well as to teach myself how the strength of poetry can inspire. And I agree with Dove that poetry can inspire writers to continue to look into the human condition of love, triumph, and tragedy. This is Josephine Zell for Mind's Eye Radio.
After all this Sturm und Drang of falling on thorns and so on, listeners may be ready for something just a bit lighter. We have just the ticket in Fran Rawl.
Snoozy Tuesday. What's going on up here in my brain? Such thin tendrils coil and uncoil octopus-like, reaching out from some unknown center for some unknown reason. I gaze around slackly, mystified by this thick veil, wading through layers of silence, touching no alive wires. No emergency flashes fight this oozing napness. The energy is not there to switch gears, and I drift like flotsam and jetsam, catching briefly on awakeness. Then I doze deeper and deeper, keep coming up for air, slower and slower. Fronds of light slowly waving. Tiny Z's hover like sweat bees, and I'm down for the count without even being fertilized. This is Fran Rawl trying to stay awake for Mind's Eye Radio.
Writer Darla Barclay learned that first important lesson: do anything you can to avoid doing the work.
For me, the writing life conjures up memories of riding the roller coaster in Santa Cruz when I was a teenager. All the feelings are present: anticipation, fear as I begin the grindingly slow ascent, doubt as I plummet to the bottom. Exhilaration fills me, and peace only comes when I surrender to the rhythm of the ups and downs. To feel secure in this ride, I follow the rules set down by those who have gone before me. I attend classes and workshops. I look to other writers for advice. I consume books on how to get published, lead with a hook, set scenes, develop characters, and discipline myself to get the work on paper. I set aside the spare room as my special place to write. I close the door when I enter this sacred space, so my two black cats, Jack and Woody, won't interrupt me. There is a west-facing window through which the sun flows and fills me with warmth even on cold winter days. The chair I have chosen is comfy, yet supportive. It is upholstered in lavender wool with a matching ottoman. Dangling above my head from the ceiling is a gift from my daughter, a metal sculpture of a woman, beautifully dressed in red and green. She has fairy wings. In her hand, she holds a typewriter. She is called the Muse of Writing. I have reams of fresh white paper, pens of every color, pencils with sharpened points. The telephone is turned off. My laptop computer patiently awaits my touch. I have written a daily schedule. Awaken. Drink coffee and read for 1 hour. Eat breakfast, do yoga, shower, edit previous writing, and get it into the computer. Eat lunch, rest, make tea, settle into my chair and write until dinner. Eat dinner, reward myself with a Netflix movie, go to bed, read, sleep. I felt really good about myself when I developed this plan. In reality, too many days I only coast. I wake up, walk past my writing room, become consumed with fear, break out in a slight sweat, make coffee, drink too many cups, read a book, read a magazine, read an old newspaper, read the back of the cereal box, clean, do laundry, accept any invitation that gets me out of the house, log onto the computer and mindlessly surf the web for hours, trying to fool myself that this is research. Take a long nap after lunch, eat lots of chocolate, watch Oprah, talk on the phone, flop onto the sofa in front of the TV after dinner. Go to bed with guilt haranguing me. You didn't write a single word all day. I flippantly quote Scarlett O'Hara, "Tomorrow is another day." I fall asleep reading someone else's words. Another day does dawn. On some mornings, I look at the stacks of fresh white paper and I want to run away. On others, I barely get my eyes open, and my muse hands me an idea for a story. I begin writing while the coffee is brewing. I write as if there is no tomorrow. I fill page after page. I don't get out of my pajamas all day. I am filled with inspiration. I am giddy with success as ideas form and become words on blank pages. I have so much fun that at the end of the day, I sing and dance around the house. I am a writer. I go to bed fatigued and feeling quite smug. Guilt is nowhere to be found. This writing life roller coaster is at once enlivening and exhausting. On the days when fear greets me in the morning, I never even get into the roller coaster car. Slick with that fine film of fear sweat, I close the door to my writing room so it can't haunt me. The most I write all day is my grocery list. My muse is on vacation. I am stuck at the bottom of the track where I wallow in self-doubt. But on those days when the muse lands on my shoulder and ignites me, I am dauntless as I strap myself in for the ride. Excitement and confidence build as words frolic from my pen. I reach a zenith as each page fills. I lift my hands above my head and I take the plunge into each new sheet of paper, laughing all the way. At the end of the day, my legs are wobbly, my face is flushed, and my supply of endorphins is depleted. Sleep beckons me. I snuggle into the pillow, looking forward to tomorrow and the chance to climb on board this incredible ride once again. This is Darla Barclay, rocking and rolling for Mind's Eye Radio.
We could go on. We hope we've given you just enough blood of our collective pens today. Thanks for tuning in to Dwelling in Possibility, or The Writing Life, written by the Mind's Eye Radio Collective of Madison, Wisconsin. The show was produced by Kelly Warren and co-produced by Gay Davidson-Zilski. Today's writers included Fran and Lou Rawl, Darla Barclay, Judith Zuckerman, Louise Mancuso, Lynn Patrick Smith, Guy Thorvaldsen, Norma Gay Pruitt, Josephine Zell, and Paul and Evelyn Thompson. Original music by Barbara Chusid. To listen to this show again and past Mind's Eye radio programs, go to www.radioforall.net. That's four with the number four. I'm your host, Greg Williard. Till next time, rave on, ye bards, and best wishes from Mind's Eye Radio.